Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Leah Gilmore.
Leah Gilmore, of course, is our Center for Emerging Media's cultural correspondent, who joins us here at least every month to talk about different issues. And we were on the internet together, and you saw this one piece written by Rebecca Solnit.
Right.
Right, that you forwarded to me.
Right. Yeah, the internet's pretty awesome like that.
It
you
is.
Know, it is.
About Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who...
Right.
Sexually assaulted a Ghanaian woman in a $3,000 night luxury hotel in New York.
Right. And you know, we have to say allegedly, because they make us do this, but we know.
Allegedly.
Right.
And he's also head of the International Monetary Fund.
Which is an extremely powerful position for one man to be in. You know, this was really one of the most well-written, brilliantly placed articles that I had read concerning, you know, what has happened with Strauss-Kahn, because what she did was make an analogy between the assault on this Ghanaian immigrant woman to the assault of the IMF on nations developing countries, which we know has been consistent ever since the development of the IMF in 1944. You know, it's been a paternalistic organization that had the best, I believe it had the best intentions at heart in the beginning.
Maybe you might.
And then the 80s. In the 80s, you know, in the 80s it became crazy. But you know what, Mark, it's sort of like so many of the whole European hegemonic policies that happen. Because, you know, we had the Berlin Conference after World War One, where the European nations got together and said, hey, you take this African country, I take that African country. You know, and let's run it. Let's have it. So then we created that scary colonialism. And with the development of the IMF during the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944 here in the United States, we developed yet another paternalistic organization that decided to govern the policies of developing and growing nations.
So, and what we want to do is forge a conversation this hour with Leah's here and with our two guests to talk about this juxtaposition of this man who we know has been accused of these kind of assaults.
Over and over again.
Creating atmospheres where women cannot work and how this ties into that same issue of power and the assault on the third world that has taken place with the International Monetary Fund destroying economies across the globe. Why Haiti can't feed itself, why Ghana can't feed itself.
That's right.
We are joined by phone this hour. Judith Ezekiel is professor of women's studies at Wright State University in Ohio and lived in France for 35 years. Lacey McCauley is an organizer with the IMF Resistance Network. Judith Ezekiel and Lacey McCauley, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Hi, Judith. Hi, Lacey. Good.
I'm actually officially an associate professor at the University of Toulouse, Le Mirail, in the south of France, and I'm visiting in the U.S. at this point.
Ah.
Wonderful. Judith, I can practice my very bad French with you. Bonjour.
And where is Toulouse, Le Mirail?
I'm sorry?
In the south.
Where is it? In the south of France?
In Toulouse, in the south of France. And I'm currently a visiting professor at Wright State University in Women's Studies.
Gotcha. All right.
Wonderful.
And Lacey, thank you for joining us as well. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm here in Washington, D.C., where, you know, twice a year we love to basically organize and shake our fists at the International Monetary Fund as they have their biannual conferences with the World Bank. Our offices are about maybe 5 blocks from where I am right now at this moment.
Good for you, Lacey. Wonderful. Judith, I'd love to ask you a question. Just understanding a bit culturally what is happening in France right now and as a reaction to Strauss-Kahn's actions the historical, you know, historically how women have been treated, you know, by powerful entities in France and how it's been accepted.
Well, I wanted to say a couple things about that. First of all, when I was first contacted by Slate, the first reaction was it was 24 hours after we had heard about this, is why are feminists taking so long to react in France? And then when feminists reacted, which they did very quickly in France as well as in the United States, everyone was saying, why are you jumping to conclusions? So we're sort of damned if we do and damned if we don't. That's the first point I'd make. One, I wanted to say right away that I'm a part of a group that has gotten together of American feminists in collaboration with French feminists and a number of other women around the world, and we've just put up a petition about 24 hours ago on change.org. I'll give you the information if you're interested, which has a statement about our position. And we wanted to make a joint statement to show that this was not, we wanted to sort of cut off the anti-French sentiment in the U.S. and the anti-American sentiment in France and say that, you know, this is a feminist issue,
right,
and we're united on this. So as far as the atmosphere in France, the French women's movement addressed the issue of rape from the very beginning in 1970. It took the U.S. till about the same time, but the U.S. movement predated the French movement by a few years. So it has been an issue that's been dealt with head-on by feminists in France, and there is a movement. I'm not just talking about a couple of individuals who in the United States people have called French feminists. There are intellectuals, numerous ones, and there's a very strong social movement that addresses most of the same issues that the American feminist movement addresses. So this is not new, of course, in France or in the United States. What's been appalling, I mean, what I did is when I was asked what French feminists felt about this, I surveyed one of my email lists that's about 800 or 900 women studies scholars as to what their concerns were in the first 24 hours. And I got back 4 points. One was, careful, he's innocent until proven guilty. And the French care very much about not showing a person in handcuffs, for instance.
Right, right.
Which in the United States we should have, because that person we usually see is a black male on in American media. And in this case, it was, you know, a powerful white man. But nevertheless, that shouldn't be shown. So that's the first point. Second point was that everyone was absolutely furious that all anyone cared about was the alleged perpetrator. And there was no the American media picked up this term chambermaid, which was appalling. It's almost a pornographic term as opposed to a hotel worker, and transformed the perpetrator into a victim, or the alleged perpetrator into a victim. A lot of the French think it's a plot. The other third point that the feminists all agreed on was that they were furious at the outpouring of sexism in media and the political class commentary in France. And there's been a little of that here as well. But it's just the comments that have been made have been utterly outrageous. And then finally, French feminists say that we have to make a distinction between people's private life, extramarital affairs, etc., and crime. And this is a crime.
This is a crime.
This is a crime.
This is a crime. And I think that's a smart thing. But I think, Judith, what is interesting to me is that what we've gotten on this side, and Mark, if you can attest or give your opinion as well, is that the media has been actually more restrained as far as the victim is concerned. You know, we don't, you know, there has not been so much focus on the maid as we usually get, you know. And why is that? There are a lot of questions about why is that. This is a good thing.
There's a fair amount of, generally, you know, you don't give the name of the victims in the media.
But the French media did.
But the French media did, exactly.
Yeah, they did. I know. That's unusual. We were surprised at that.
Well, we take it for an element of, you know, there's race involved, there's class involved. And a lot of times when we are involved, even with African-American women victims, we do get a certain amount of blaming the victim that has happened not happened on this side of the ocean as of yet.
Although there have been some figures I saw, I did see, and I don't remember the name. There have been people, but I think they've been mostly on the right who have said that this is, you know, this is anti-Semitism or that this whatever, that it's a plot.
Right, Ben Stein for the American Conservative.
Exactly.
Right,
Spectator.
Not to name the person. One step, though, just to say as far as the status of women in France. It's funny, I just did a class on that last week. And if you look at the overall status of women, in some respects it's much better, and in some respects it's much worse. I mean, we have health care, maternity leave. We have a parity law that has brought France up to, I believe, 67th position in terms of political representation, or I don't remember the exact figure, but it's still pathetic, but there is that on the books. We have signed CEDAW, which the U.S. has not. There are all sorts of issues like that in terms of labor law, in terms of health care, child care, things of that sort, in which France, women in France, the status of women is better. Now, there is this broad, though, complicity under the guise of saying this is a person's private life, allowing for or hindering sexual harassment and women from going to the police with rape, et cetera. I think that attitude that this is personal or this is seduction or
right.
that there's no war of the sexes in France. But I think this may be its Waterloo. I think that that is done with. I think this very well may change the way people in the media and the political powers speak of this. As far as the issue of race, it is certainly a question. It wasn't initially because we didn't know who the victim was. But if you just, I mean, that's one of the points our petition makes, is that the way that Strauss-Kahn himself and other people have talked about him, they use terms like civilized.
Exactly.
It's very, very neocolonial discourse. And I agree that race is primordial in this particular case.
So in the piece that Rebecca Solnit wrote, I just want to read a few of the paragraphs. I'm going to turn to Lacey McCauley is to talk about these, because to me it's this connection, this insidious
that's what's brilliant
connection between the power of this man Dominic Strauss-Kahn and the power he weighs in over women and everybody else, and that the total disregard of it in allegedly of this Ghanaian woman, and also the total disregard the International Monetary Fund has had for third world countries and in developing countries, and how their entire economies have been torn asunder. Even Bill Clinton, a few years back, had to apologize for
That's
being
right.
part of that by destroying the economies of Guinea, Ghana, countries throughout Africa, Haiti, which can no longer feed itself because
right.
of the policies of
and
the International
even,
Monetary Fund.
Even so, after Haiti, you know, Mark, what happened with the IMF was even after the vast earthquake, they wanted to impose even more loans. And it was the power of activism that made this not happen.
To stop them.
That's right.
So this, let me just the first few paragraphs and ask Lacey McCauley to jump into this. I'll open the phones here at 410-319-8888. And Rebecca Solnit wrote, how can I tell a story we already know too well? Her name was Africa.
Yeah.
His was France. He colonized her, exploited her, silenced her. And even decades after it was supposed to have ended, still acted with a high hand resolving her affairs in places like Cote d'Ivoire, a name she had been given because of her export products, not her identity. Her name was Asia. His was Europe. Her name was silence. His was power. Her name was poverty. His was wealth. Her name was her. But what was hers? His name was his, and he presumed everything was his, including her. And he thought he could take her without asking, without consequences. It's a very old story, though its outcome has been changing little in recent decades. And this time around, the consequences are shaking a lot of foundations, all of which clearly needed shaking. Who would ever write a fable as obvious, as heavy-handed, as the story we've just been given? The extraordinarily powerful head of the International Monetary Fund, a global organization that created mass poverty and economic injustice, allegedly assaulted a hotel maid, an immigrant from Africa, in a hotel's luxury suite in New York City. Lacey McCauley?
Well, Mark, I definitely am so familiar with Rebecca Solnit and her work and respect her very much. She says so well what many of us who actually have been protesting the International Monetary Fund for years have been saying. Of course, when I heard this, about Dominique Strauss-Kahn assaulting a hotel worker on that Saturday afternoon when he was taken off the plane, my first thought is, of course, because the International Monetary Fund, under Strauss-Kahn and under all of its administration, is actually an organization that does have a sociopathic impact on the rest of the world. You know, Strauss-Kahn's his alleged sex attack on an African immigrant from Guinea, it's a harrowing metaphor for how the IMF treats the rest of the world. And it's very interesting because once I heard that the woman who he has attacked was from Guinea, I actually started looking at the IMF's what it had been doing in Guinea. Mm-hmm. And in a little blog post that I wrote for the Institute for Policy Studies, I actually went into how the woman who he attacked arrived in the U.S. from Guinea 7 years ago under what her lawyer says is very difficult circumstances. And she may have, and of course none of us know because she's not talking about this, but she may have actually been assaulted by the IMF in her home country, in Guinea, and then came to the U.S. Perhaps to look for a better life for her and for her daughter. She was assaulted again by Dominique Strauss-Kahn.
When you said assaulted in Guinea, you're talking about assaulted economically.
Economically, right. They actually, basically more than 15 years ago, the IMF jumped into the country's economics when they basically issued a loan. One of the things that the reporting is actually painting a picture of is that the IMF is some sort of, you know, charity organization or something like that. It loans country monies in tough times, you know. And this is something that it's, I think, entirely false. And basically, what the IMF does is it's a bank, and like any other, they exist to make money, and they make money on the very poor countries and the cash-strapped countries that they're going into. It's basically, you know, they. I mentioned I'm about five blocks away from their offices. They have several large buildings, pretty much next door to the White House, give or take, you know, a little tiny bit. They're huge, shiny buildings with, you know, beautiful-looking fountains in front of them. This is not the building of a charity organization.
Exactly.
It's a bank. And in fact, these are one of the things that I like to point out is that they're loan sharks. They actually loan countries money in very tough times, and they exact strictures in exchange. They actually they don't just loan the money. They don't just say, "Hey, Guinea, I know that you are having some rough times. You know, here's a few billion dollars to get you through." They don't do that at all. They actually they jump into the country, they send their economists, and their economists actually look at what the expenditures that the country that the country is making at that time, and they basically cut out anything that the government is doing that is actually a social service. They cut out education, they cut out health care, they cut out food subsidies for farmers. They cut out a variety of different social services like retirement plans.
Mm-hmm. Even in Greece, not only in the
That's right. I was thinking that as well. You know, Lacey.
My father's an Irish citizen, actually. They did, you know, they also instituted these strictures in Ireland. And so I feel very close to that issue. And that's not all, actually. They also basically force a country to lower its defenses. They force a country to lower its tariffs, lower its quotas, and the effect is actually it enables corporations to basically go and go forth and basically prosper in a country without any oftentimes any respect for labor laws, labor policies, or environment policies.
So it's
hard on people.
I'm only trying to get to some callers who have called in here to join us at 410-319-8888. When we come back from that, I want to hear what both of you think this moment means. What do we wrestle with from both these perspectives in this moment?
Can I just add two short things?
Yeah, sure, because we do want to get to the phones, but go ahead. Yeah.
One is that there's also an excellent article in The Guardian by Greg Palast called Strauss-Kahn Screws Africa.
Yes,
excellent.
That gives some very specifics as to what the IMF did in Guinea. But I would also like, and I agree with what's been said, but I would also like to say that this woman is not a metaphor. that this is an actual woman, a human being, and that I get uncomfortable if we, as much as I agree with the title that Strauss-Kahn and the IMF screws Africa and Greece and a number of places, I still think that Strauss-Kahn's victims have not just been women of color. They've not just been, you know, maids in hotels, apparently. There has been, at the very least, sexual harassment on an ongoing basis, and that he's not the only one. I mean, everyone is so upset now about Schwarzenegger's marital infidelities. Well, when he was being elected, it came out, there were a number of stories coming out about him groping women. That is not personal marital infidelity. That's actually a crime. So, or it's a form of at least discrimination, if not a crime. So the way in which women are treated, and for instance, the way women are treated in Guinea is not exemplary, and we mustn't glorify it. There's pretty much generalized genital mutilation, for instance, in Guinea. So I want us to be very careful not to only make the victim or the alleged victim a metaphor. She's a woman who is sharing an experience that, you know, women of color and other women experience when sexualized power comes into play.
No, it's an important point.
I think so too. And she's so much beyond a metaphor. And as women of color have been victims of this, have undergone this sort of victimization, as well as women from all over the world, and we deal with class as well.
But no man, white or black, in the United States has ever been sentenced to death for the rape of a black woman in the United States.
There you go.
For instance.
And that says more than anything, and the value placed upon black womanhood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It is still in 2011, still a very difficult situation.
And I think that you can talk again in a larger sense about the International Monetary Fund and its policies are directly and indirectly perhaps responsible for what has been let loose in places like Rwanda and the Congo, in Zaire, where mass rapes are taking place, because of the complete dislocation of those countries, the economy falling apart,
the blind eye,
the mines being sold off to large corporations, and the madness that has ensued. Let's go to the phones here. Many people have called in. 410-319-8888. We have with us this hour. Lee and I have with us this hour two really interesting guests. Judith Ezekiel, who is professor at the Université de Toulouse-Lautrec in France. She's now a visiting professor of women's studies at Wright State University here in Ohio, has lived in France for 35 years. Lacey McCauley, who's an organizer with the IMF Resistance Network. Both their work can be seen on our website at steinershow.org. Leah Gilmore, our Center for Emerging Media's cultural correspondent in the studio here, who said we really have to do the show this week together, and so we're in the studio doing it now. Number here is 410-319-8888. And Laura in California, you're on the air.
Wow.
Hi, Judith. I'm glad I got through. I'm a colleague of Judith.
Hi, Laura.
The feminist internationalist world.
Well, go ahead, Laura.
Yes. Well, I just wanted particularly to thank everyone coming together in this conversation and so from so many different angles and perspectives and making them all weave together. I think it's a really beautiful program.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I've spent many years, decades actually, working to raise awareness about rape in a variety of ways, both at the rape crisis level but also the legislative level. And I think this is a very important turning point in understanding, much as the moment was in 1978, where there was a trial for the first time of a man who had raped his wife while they were living together. And the population of Salem, Oregon basically doubled from the media coming in because there was a tremendous shock. People came from France as well. From the media, that any woman would do such a thing, and she's supposed to be consenting, and that's what marriage is all about, and it was quite shocking, I would say,
mm-hmm.
to those of us who were, let's call us more civilized. I think Judith's point about civilized is very important because it implies that his victim was savage, And it was he who was, quote, savage, though I hate to use that phrase because, again,
but that is the implication. Right.
So I think he was just operating in a typical, shall we call it, male supremacist way in which he felt that he was entitled to all women. And he really is extraordinary about that in the sense that, well, not that extraordinary, but because he has access to so many women of different classes and races, and he is who he is, he just, across the board, is a harasser, which is usually a civil situation in terms of a fine that you get.
Right.
But I do want to say that I am in California, and that I was absolutely horrified that people voted for someone who wasn't criminal, and the press had actually interviewed people, and they were quite clear about the fact that groping is a crime. Any unwanted touching is a crime, as otherwise known as battery. Sexual battery is unwanted sexual touching. And it was very hard to live with having someone like that for governor because, again, he was voted in that dreadful election. And then, but this entitlement of men over women,
exactly.
You feel it every day as you go anywhere. But I think the thing I want to say most of all is that her testimony to whomever, I'm not sure, that the media picked up about how she kept begging him not to do this to her.
Right.
Really resonates with me. I remember the first time I read it, I wept. And she kept saying, please don't do this, I'll lose my job.
Right.
Trying to appeal to him as if he had a conscience.
Which he has none.
Exactly.
His answer.
Whether socially, politically, or humanly.
Right. And the fact that she's begging for her job, you know, while he's committing a crime, that maybe he would understand her on this level instead of as a woman and a fellow human being. It's tragic. I was also near tears.
He, his answer was, baby, don't worry about it. Don't you know who I am? That's how she reported it. And it was so emblematic
right.
of the entitlement, of the ownership of women, that I think that, you know, that should have been in the New York Times quote of the day kind of thing. It might have even been. I just didn't pick up on it.
Well, we have to take a break here, and we'll come back and open the phone to everyone to join us here in this conversation. I think that, let me just say as we go to break, that that this Ghanaian woman is somebody who, keep me just out for a second, is someone that has that we really need to look up to,
right?
In terms of her standing up to this power.
That's right. That's exactly.
And as a representative of all women who have been attacked and sexually assaulted for standing up as an African woman in this country. One of the most powerful men in the world. And this is a very important both political, social moment and a moment that has to do with the rights of women around the world. This is emblematic of a lot.
And that this woman was listened to, that they came on the plane and got this man. It really is a pivotal moment.
So Leah Gilmore and I will be right back with Judith Ezekiel and Lacey McCauley. As we go there, remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. More information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We'll be right back. I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Leah Gilmore.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. We are talking about Dominique Strauss-Kahn and the International Monetary Fund.
Right.
His alleged sexual assault on a Ghanaian woman who worked cleaning rooms in a luxury hotel in New York. He's now under house arrest in New York City.
In a luxury house arrest.
But they moved into the Lower East Side, and they had to move to a smaller apartment.
Okay.
Man. And also about the International Monetary Fund that he ran. He was about to run for president of France as a socialist.
A socialist, right.
A bit of contradiction there, mm-hmm. at least for me. That he was supposed to run for president of France. And this also is gonna, it brings to light lots of issues. I think it could help us unearth the International Monetary Fund and our international policies rape the world and create conditions for emigration around the world. People see that this woman did came to America because she had to survive.
It also will take the mystery out of what the IMF is.
Exactly.
And that's what's happening now.
And we are joined here this hour, Lee and I are, by Judith Ezekiel, a professor at the University de Toulouse-Lautrec in France, and she's now also a visiting professor of women's studies at Wright State University in Ohio, lived in France for 35 years. Lacey McCauley, who is organizer for the IMF Resistance Network, who joins us from Washington, D.C., and you all out there at 410-319-8888. Let me go to the phones right away, folks, if you don't mind, and get people in here to join us. And I think Laura may still be on the phone. You can see in this conversation. Bob, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Bob.
Welcome.
No, my name is Bob.
It says Bob on my screen. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, that's whoever took the call.
Well, go ahead.
First of all, I look at the IMF as a loan shark and international gangster operation. And I'm glad Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe said that he wasn't going to pay them anything back that they had strung him out for, his country out for, as comparison with the actions of Cecil Rhodes. And I've seen the French in Cote d'Ivoire. I've seen some of the behavior of the French in Cote d'Ivoire. And personally, I never consider Africa as the third world. I consider it as the first world, Europe, and also along with Asia. I consider Europe and this country as the third world. I don't use them type of terms as Africa. With the history of Africa, you can go back millions of years and its progress and all its wonderful things. How can you say anything third about that? That is the third world when it is really the first world. And you can ask Africans in Haiti about the French behavior. If it was all that good, then Toussaint Louverture and the rest of those people in Haiti, those African warriors, would have never liberated themselves from these French beasts. That's my opinion.
All right. Thank you so much,
Thank you, Baba.
Baba, I think that this is Lacey McAuley. I think you're absolutely, accurate when it comes to what do we call countries who are just basically colonized by the wealthy, like Dominique Strauss-Kahn, by people from wealthy countries? Is it the third world? Do we call them poor countries? Actually, Africa is one of the richest, houses one of the richest sets of ecosystems for, the entire giant landmass of Africa houses a lot of very rich ecosystems, and that's exactly why it has been colonized by other countries, and that's why it's been basically preyed upon by the International Monetary Fund. And I think it's important to note that, it is that same sort of sense of entitlement, that same sort of sense of, being able to go into a country and, that basically I'm entitled to these resources. I'm entitled to do business here and buy up land, to pollute and to mine. That sense of entitlement also is the same sense of entitlement that oftentimes leads to, sociopathic behavior like Dominique Strauss-Kahn's attack of the hotel worker. And this is something, I think that we all should keep in mind. It's actually, that sort of colonizers or imperialist sort of sense that, this is mine and it should belong to me. But when in actuality, that's totally not the case.
And we're still suffering the ramifications of that, Lacey. If the whole, even though we're in a post-colonial time, there's still attitudes that I think Lacey's right on the mark when she talks about the sense of entitlement that keeps perpetuating itself. And as she said, the entitlement that Strauss-Kahn felt when allegedly attacking this young woman. I am absolutely To me, this is very important when we think about what to call these countries. It seems like a small thing, but calling someplace third world or calling them poor countries is really, again, indicative of the whole hegemonic thing. What do we call these countries? How do we approach these countries? I think, again, that this IMF situation has opened up so much dialogue and so much opportunity on to know exactly what's going on. And we also have to realize that, you know, the governor of the IMF is Timothy Geithner for the United States. And the alternate governor for the IMF is Ben Bernanke. So we're talking about the imposing of United States economic policies on the rest of the world.
The World Bank always has an American head. The IMF always has a European head.
There you go.
But they're close.
But both of them operate according to the so-called Washington consensus.
Exactly.
Basically takes, it takes a country, the Washington consensus sort of thinkers, they take a country, they divide it up into a set of resources, natural, beautiful ecosystems become natural resources. People who are, just living are thought of as, quote, cheap labor. And this is, I think, an entirely false way to think about people and planet.
And these are real policies. These are real policies. These are not just, observations. These divisions are actual IMF policy.
Mm-hmm. So let me.
Well, although it is also in continuation. I mean, you talked about Rwanda and Burundi, the Belgian colonization and decolonization, began that process, and it's a continuum. But I would also say that we could extend this to a discussion about so-called development. I was struck by the difference, the reputation, for instance, that Doctors Without Borders has, and after the Haiti catastrophes, where other groups would go in and use local resources or help local resources or cross, their development that's self-development or cross-country in West Africa development rather than going in like Zorro and bringing in a bag of rice and paying French doctors to go in and do what local people are perfectly well qualified to do. So I think that there would be obviously I think this is going to blow the top off this reputation of Strauss-Kahn as having been a slightly gentler IMF
right.
than previously. That's certainly been put to rest. But I think that the discussion needs to go on to development and the continuum between colonialism, the IMF, and many of the development programs that we're seeing.
So I'm curious, going back to the question of Dominique and the question of this. We talked earlier about his the domination of this of his sense of privilege, his sense of the IMF sense of control in the entire planet, but it also represents the same issue around women.
Absolutely,
right.
I'm assuring that
is this Judith
your
again?
Listeners know this. This is Judith.
Yes.
Most of your listeners know this, but you can't use lie detector tests with men, no matter what their class or race, when it comes to rape, because they're convinced that she wanted it. So they can pass a lie detector case. A lie detector test, even if
I've never thought about
that.
I've never thought about that.
It's very
really.
Clear, and there's witnesses even that this was a rape. There have been many studies where they ask various men if they could get away with it, would they do something? And if you don't use the word rape, you get a very strong percentage of men saying that they would do this or that when the woman said no, and I would do it anyway. There's a sense of entitlement that's a gendered sense of entitlement. Mm. It's racialized as well. Of course, but it is not just powerful men in that sense. It's a sense of entitlement that men and people who are in positions of domination
because of
race, class, or gender. So that sense of entitlement is not just because he's rich and powerful. It's also because he's a man.
410-319-8888 our number here. And let's go back to the phones. Kader, you're on the air.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. My name is Kader Kamara. I'm an immigrant from Guinea. I live here in Baltimore. I've been here for 30 years, but I do business in Guinea. I go there, travel there like twice a year. Are you listening?
Yeah, go ahead. We just listen to you. Go ahead.
Dominique case is a very, it's been a lot of dialogue because I've been talking about this before this happened. People have to take it from very far away because the executive working from IMF going back to Africa, doing third world country, like let's take an example on Guinea, for example. I've been giving like a free breakfast in their stay over there in the morning. I'm talking about authority over there giving them women for free. And this is true.
Mm-hmm.
So Dominic, he was in a very familiar position in New York. Well, he knows very well what's going on. His art is not permitted here. It's a risky thing, but he was in a very familiar atmosphere in New York. So he took it for granted, and he got caught up. So you have to take it from the basic. I believe the authority back in Africa have made these people too comfortable doing what he did here, back there, and he got caught up here.
That's so are you stating that when in Africa, they are given women?
Of course, by the authority over there, just to make them comfortable mm-hmm. wherever they come doing over there. They've been getting this for free. And some of the women, I'm not going to say that they get forced to do what they have to do, these people, but that's what it's been happening for many years, for a long time, and I've been talking about it.
Right. I don't discount it. I mean, there have been I spend a lot of time in Europe, particularly in France and Belgium throughout the year. And by no means, and Judith can attest to this, you know, it's difficult when you talk about different situations, not to sound like you're culture bashing. But there definitely is, as a woman of color, as an African-American woman, I have definitely been approached in a very sexualized, entitled way. And was even both in France and Belgium. And I'm always struck that this seemed to be culturally accepted. And Judith, you have referred to this a little bit earlier in our conversation. But do you see that in your studies and with your students, and it's particularly your students of color, that there is this over-sexualization of women of color in France?
You know, I hate to talk from impression. Mm-hmm. I think that it's very different in France than the U.S. I think that in France, you know, I used to say that seduction is the national sport, and sometimes that is with, you know, elements of power that go every which way, and that's not, you know, that for instance, it is indeed not at all shocking for a person to transgress in their personal lives. In France or in the U.S., and when I say transgress, there are big quotation marks around it.
Of course, but it's not criminal.
To be a part of their private life. For instance, just to give an example, the mayor of Paris is gay, and in the U.S. that would have been made a big deal of, and he admitted it once, which was surprising to the media, and said, I'll say this once, and then we won't talk about it ever again. And that's perfectly acceptable. So in terms of seduction, that's one thing. In terms of sexual harassment, sexual assault, and rape, that's another thing. And yes, for instance, our sexual harassment laws in France are more recent, and they've been more restrictive, and there's been a lot less prosecution of sexual harassment there than there has been here. However, there hasn't been that much here either. You know, it's pretty hard to do here, too. So, you know, I don't want to generalize. I can't answer that, you know, this is acceptable, this isn't. In the petition that I mentioned, one of the signers is a Ghanaian living in France who's the daughter of a Pan-African labor leader from the 50s and 60s, and she is involved in politics and stepped right up and signed this. And she's always been, you know, a strong feminist as well.
Right.
So
I've spoken with an African feminist who lives in France. The name is escaping me. And this was actually one of her points, which she is fighting pretty much, you know, the constant view of women of color in a certain type of way. So I think it is very important for women of color in France who are feminists to be vocal and out loud and to partner with the work that you're doing, Judith.
Mm-hmm. So, it's interesting that we talked about, just a little quick aside, that the mayor mm-hmm. of Paris, Patron Delano, is also in the Socialist Party.
You're right. Yeah.
Now that Dominique Strauss-Kahn has been will be indicted and tried, will not be running for president of France, most likely. Mm-hmm. That Bertrand Delano
is considering
talking
just
about running
that.
For president of France. So that would be an interesting twist of fate. When I just said that, something else I think is important to talk about here. Dominique Strauss-Kahn was going to run for president of France, mm-hmm. as so on the Socialist Party ticket, but run for the nomination. And to me, this is indicative also of the insidious and tight and close relationship between the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, our banks, the way that we exploit the world, and our political leaders, and that they are both, and the interaction between the two.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the current world situation, the immigration problem, the immigration issues we have on the world, not necessarily problem, the immigration issues we have in the world, are directly tied to these policies that have destroyed the agricultural base of countries around the globe that are not part of the Western world. And people run for president. They become secretaries of the Treasury. They also serve for with the IMF governors. They are head of the IMF. They run for president of France. And that relationship maybe is something that will begin to come to light. It could come to light. This could be very revealing, both in terms of dealing with sexual oppression and universal oppression, and how they're connected. Mm-hmm. Starting at just your thoughts on that, we'll to Lacey and Judith.
Well, the problem, of course, with this is that the current president of France and the person who this may benefit if the socialists don't really take this by the horns and step up is was elected as a racist. Sarkozy, what pushed him into mm-hmm. this position and into the position of being able to be elected, was a racist position. I can explain if you want. During and provoking the biggest riots that France had seen since.
Right, I was there during that time. It was profoundly amazing.
Yes, and that he was then elected after having made such racist comments. You know, nobody voted for Sarkozy who at least does not tolerate that kind of position. And, of course, the third person in the running is a neo-fascist, Marine Le Pen. You know, that's one of the concerns a lot of my feminist friends had, is that if this throws the election, it's going to be a catastrophe. So the pressure is on at this point, and we all have to be pressuring the socialists to step up, to face this, and to produce a good candidate who is different in every way that we were talking about than Strauss-Kahn was.
Lacey?
That was
well,
Lacey.
I think that Mark made a very, very valid and important point, and that's that oppression and sexual oppression and economic oppression are all part of the same sort of skewed way of thinking. And I think that, you know, there is, and it, in fact, you know, either political party, you know, they are going to be beholden, both in France and in the U.S. and in many other countries, to actually moneyed interests. And this is something that is true of the International Monetary Fund. It's something that's true of the Department of Treasury in the U.S. It's actually the moneyed interests that are asserting much more control than they actually should. And it has a lot of bearing and incredibly unjust bearing on our political system in the U.S. and it does in France. And, you know, this might actually, the fact, you know, that it's being so widely reported that Dominique Strauss-Kahn, one of the most powerful people in the world up until, you know, just a week and a half ago,
right.
Was going to be, you know, he was head of an organization that very few people actually even knew about.
Exactly.
The National Monetary Fund. But he's, you know, he's part of the moneyed elite, and here he is trying to step into a role of public servant, and I don't think that that's right. And I hope that we can actually, in a wider way, begin to have this conversation about is it right? I mean, is it right to have, you know, these moneyed interests actually controlling our institutions? And I guess I do take example from the incredibly brave woman who actually fought off her attacker. This basically he tried to tell her, you know, don't you know who I am? She just fought him off. She didn't stop fighting. And she went and told people what happened after she was attacked in that hotel room. And she had
in a unionized hotel, which is
in
crucial.
In a unionized hotel.
What did you say,
true.
Judith? A unionized
in a
hotel?
A unionized hotel.
And the fact
that's
that
important.
That is important.
She was a union, you know, union employee actually protected her job, which enabled her to.
That's the part I didn't read.
And this is not an unprecedented happening. in hotels. Mm-hmm. This is something that is part of a bigger problem. And it goes unreported, and it, you know, it, even though when it goes reported, there was actually just an article about that in the Huffington Post, New York, about even though these women are reporting these attacks against them, these sexual assaults against them, they're told to shut up and make sure it goes away. So this woman was very brave because she must have pushed at another level in order for it to get to this point.
And if there hadn't been,
and she still is,
She still is employed.
Right.
Well, she still is pushing. She's still
pushing.
You know, pursuing the case.
And Judith would just make a great point about the union. If there hadn't been a union, that wouldn't have happened. So
do we have time for another caller? No, we don't. First of all, let me do this then. I appreciate people calling in. So we couldn't get to this next round of callers who called in. I want to thank both Judith Ezekiel, who is professor at the Université de Toulouse-Le Mireuil, and also visiting professor of women's studies at Wright State University in Ohio. And
may I give the name of the petition that we've launched?
Please do.
We'll put it on our website as well.
Feminists Demand Let Justice Be Done, and it is on change.org. You'll have to probably Google. I can't give you the whole address.
What we'll do is we'll put that on our website, standardshow.org.
And, also Facebook.
To raise funds to support the woman who is who was the alleged victim of Daniel Sloskan.
Excellent.
Perfect. And we will have all that on our website, Judith, so people can get right to that. And Lacey McCauley will have your blog on our website. I want to thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lacey and Judith.
Great discussion. Thank you both for taking all your busy time, and your friend Laura from California from calling in as well.
Yes, wonderful. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, and thank you much, Leah Gilmore, for co-hosting today and being here in our studios.
Always a pleasure.
Always good to have you here. As we run out of here, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Marlene and Stuart Greenebaum Cancer Center, an NCI-designated cancer center providing research, treatment, and education to further the prevention of and cure for cancer. Online at www.umgcc.org, or the number for more information is 1-800-888-8823, or you can go to steinershow.org, click on the University of Maryland Medical Center's banner, and all the information will be right there. Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Cricket Aronson and Justin Levy. We're engineered today by Zachary Coleman. Our theme music is by Warren Matthews of Clean Cuts. Our intern today is Justin Mayhew. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, and find out information about our guests and their work, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. For Leah Gilmore, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.